5 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Turkey's targeting Kurds in Syria. Turkey says its bombardment of Kurdish fighters in northern Syria will continue, despite calls for a halt from the U.S. and France. The U.S.-backed Kurds, whom the Turks believe are seeking an autonomous state, continue battling Islamist fighters. Peter Bechtold says the Turks view armed Kurds anywhere as a potential threat.
If there is a Kurdish separatist movement, it will take a quarter of Turkey in the southeastern region. And so whenever there's a Kurdish organization that becomes armed, they're afraid, here they come, because this struggle has been going on since the 1920s. It may not have been on American radar screens, but it's been going on ever since.
Meanwhile, President Obama Sunday spoke by phone with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, urging Moscow to play, quote, a constructive role in the Syrian crisis by ceasing its air campaign against moderate opposition forces. Friday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, announced a plan for a cessation of hostilities within a week. Ballots are being counted from Sunday's presidential runoff in Central African Republic as the country seeks to end nearly 3 years of sectarian violence. Two former prime ministers are vying for the top job, with the winner facing the daunting task of restoring peace and reuniting the nation. Candidate Anissa Georges Dologwele, who won the first round December 30th, taking about 24% of the vote, described the sense of duty and joy among the people and the prospect of starting a new era in the former French colony. He faces Faustin Archange Touadéra, who took nearly 20% in the first round. The violence between Muslim rebels and Christian militia has killed thousands, with some half a million fleeing the country. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has used a visit to Albania to thank the government there for its opposition against the Islamic State, or Daesh, and resettling members of an Iranian opposition group known as the Mujahideen al-Khalq, or MEK, who've been living in camps in Iraq.
Albania has been there from the beginning, willing to stand by all countries in opposition to Daesh, and it is standing up with us in support of Iraq, it is standing up with us in support of Afghanistan, and it is standing with us in the long-term struggle to emphasize to people the importance of tolerance.
Over the past 2 years, Albania has taken in some 1,000 members of MEK and has committed to resettling another 2,000. Mr. Kerry's visit comes at a time when Albania is trying to adopt judicial reform as part of a wider effort to combat corruption. Russia has blocked Ukraine-registered trucks from entering its territory following expanded efforts by activists in Ukraine to block Russian transit from crossing into or leaving Ukraine. Both sides imposed a series of food products import and air traffic bans as tensions have risen and armed conflict in eastern Ukraine erupted 2 years ago after the Russian parliament annexed the Crimean Peninsula. The UN Sunday said Afghan hostilities left more than 3,500 civilians dead, nearly 7,500 others wounded last year, an increase of 4% in casualties from the previous year. Nicholas Haysom is with the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan.
We recognize that all the parties to the conflict have agreed on the need to avoid civilian casualties. But what we need to see are those same parties going beyond public statements to change the way they conduct the war.
The report, however, documented a 10% reduction in civilian casualties as a result of Taliban attacks. Five Palestinians have been killed and another critically wounded by Israeli forces in the West Bank. Since October, Palestinian stabbings, shootings, and assaults have killed 27 Israelis, while at least 160 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli troops. Authorities in Democratic Republic of Congo briefly detained prominent opposition figure Martin Fayulu Sunday, 2 days before a call general strike aimed at pressuring President Joseph Kabila to step down from office. Mr. Kabila is legally required to step aside in December after 15 years in power. Egypt's highest court Sunday reversed a 15-year prison sentence handed down by a lower court to policeman Yasin Hatem in the death of protester Sharima Sabag. She was struck with birdshot January of last year during a march marking the fourth anniversary of the uprising that ousted longtime leader Hosni Mubarak. The death in Tahrir Square caused outrage in Egypt. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, February 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The people of Central African Republic voted Sunday in a presidential runoff election.
The first round of the legislative elections last month was so flawed with irregularities, the results were cancelled. The head of the African Union Election Observer Mission in CAR, Suleiman Ndene Ndiaye, said this time round the polling stations seemed to have enough ballot papers.
That's VOA correspondent Nick Long in Bangui. With two more days before Uganda's presidential election, main opposition party FDC responds to police warnings about holding night rallies. We'll also have reaction to Saturday's Uganda presidential election debate. And Burundi's opposition leader says those who accuse Rwanda of destabilizing Burundi are missing the point.
Nkurunziza wants to make this problem as an ethnic problem. But as a leader, we say no. The problem is not an ethnic problem. It's a political problem.
Jaminani is the exile leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, or FRUDEBO. And some experts say the African Union mission in Somalia is not protecting civilians from Al-Shabaab. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's post in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Voters in the Central African Republic went to the polls on Sunday in the final round of presidential elections and a rerun of election to the National Assembly. Nick Long reports from the capital, Bangui.
Polling stations were relatively quiet, with just a trickle of people voting at several centres, but in the afternoon, VOA saw many more people arriving to vote. Georges Anissé Doleguele, one of the two candidates in the presidential runoff, spoke to reporters outside Bangui City Hall. He wished everyone a happy Valentine's Day and said that as Valentine's Day is a festival of love, he would like Central Africans to think of voting as an act of love for the country. There was a livelier atmosphere outside the Buganda High School in Bangui, where the other presidential challenger, Faustin Archange Touadéra, went to cast his ballot.
En tout cas, au vu de ce que nous avons pendant les meetings dans nos réunions.
In view of what we've seen in the rallies and meetings during the campaign, which have often been very well attended, he says, I think our compatriots have heard the message and they'll act on it at the polling stations. There were 30 candidates in the first round of the presidential election, 20 of whom have since said they are backing Touadéra, while three say they're backing Doleguele. Many of those voters may abstain in the second round. Doleguele said it was too early to say if there would be many abstentions. Only a few voters VOA spoke to were willing to say how they'd voted. This student said he voted for Touadéra because he was paid his bursary regularly during the time Touadéra was prime minister up until 2013. And he thought Touadéra had done other good things, such as paying government workers regularly and upgrading some roads.
Je pense que c'est une personnalité qui incarne le changement.
This man said he voted for Doleguele because he embodies change, whereas if the other candidate is elected, he said, it will be more of the same. The first round of the legislative elections last month was so flawed with irregularities, the results were cancelled. The head of the African Union Election Observer Mission in CAR, Suleiman Ndene Ndiaye, said this time round the polling stations seemed to have enough ballot papers. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
It's three more days before Ugandans go to the polls in the presidential election, where incumbent Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power for 30 years, is running for re-election. On Sunday, Police Chief General Kale Kayihura warned main opposition candidate Chisa Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change, FDC, against holding political rallies at night, something that the police chief said is in violation of Electoral Commission regulations. FDC President retired General Mugisha Muntu said his party will not stop holding night rallies until President Museveni and his ruling National Resistance Movement Party respect the same Electoral Commission laws.
Basically, what the police should do is stop applying double standards. If really they have a problem with the holding of rallies tonight, I would believe that the best thing they have done is to call for a meeting of the Electoral Commission and all the candidates and then sit down and see how to resolve that issue. But not just threatening one side when we know that other candidates are also having the same difficulties. And it's not that that is deliberate. It's just that you find a very tight program and it happens that rallies spill over. beyond the time that is officially allotted. That the best thing would be to ask the Electoral Commission, meet with all the candidates, and see how to resolve that issue, because it affects all, well, at least for us, and we also know that the candidate Mutebeni has been getting into the same situation. So the application of double standards, I think, is the wrong thing for them to do at this point in time. More so when we are coming to the end of the campaign, 2 days. Just ending the campaigns in 2 days. And of all these night rallies, the ones that when they spilled over into the night, all round, there has been no incident. So I would wonder what is making them excited.
You mentioned the campaigns are coming to an end. Final rallies, I understand your party and President Museveni or the NRM are having rallies in Kampala City.
The Kampala City and the campaign period is winding up on Tuesday. Wednesday is the free day nobody is allowed to campaign. And Thursday is the voting day.
How do you think the FDC, the party, your party, how is it doing? Having gone around to meet with the people of Uganda, how do you think your party going into the final round? How are you doing?
We built momentum all around the country. There are clear signals that we will be able to take the vote come 18th. And we are going to do the best we can to ensure that we protect the vote, because we know that there is a lot of panic in the movement, the party which is in power, and I suspect that that's why possibly there is the panic that there is, you know, throwing threats and all that, because they know that they don't have the vote. They know that in a free and fair and transparent election that they will lose this vote.
Retired General Mugisha Muntu is president of Uganda's main opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Ugandans tuned in on Saturday as the nation's first ever presidential debate attended by all candidates, including President Yoweri Museveni, took place in Kampala. Many say it was a small victory for democracy. Elizabeth Pollard reports from Kampala.
In homes and bars across the country, Ugandans were fixated on their screens as the eight political candidates running for president took part in the national debate. Those who could not watch tuned in on their cell phones, cheering and applauding as candidates addressed issues important to them. At the forefront was President Yoweri Museveni, who was running for his fifth term in office. Speculation over whether President Museveni would attend the debate was rampant throughout the capital, up until the moment he stepped onto the red carpet at the debate hall. Excitement was high as the debate got underway.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now have a full house.
Crispy Kaheru, a coordinator with the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, attended the debates and said it shows an important shift in how citizens are encouraging political dialogue in Uganda.
Uganda is one of those countries where the culture of debate is not deeply entrenched. And seeing us making baby steps in that direction is very much encouraging. And beyond a debate of this nature, I think it lays a foundation for dialogue processes to happen post the election, which is important for this country.
This was a sentiment shared by many, including Jermaine Igesa, who says the organization of the event and questions posed gave him a feeling of empowerment.
I must say it makes sense discussing foreign policy with the incumbent who has been largely in charge of the foreign policy. It made a lot of sense for me. On the overall, I think it's a telling statement for people who do not believe Africa can actually practice democracy. I mean, I have been to foreign countries. I know how some stereotypes are about African politics, but I think it's a telling statement. There were no fist fights. There was no name calling. It was very civil. It's been very decent. Everybody has put their best foot forward.
Supporters of President Museveni, such as Susan Ojira, said she was glad Museveni could attend the debates this time and that she preferred his straightforward style to answering questions.
The other time when he was so busy, they started speculating that he's fearing the debate. Why should he fear debate? We feel honored. We shall feel excited because we are sure of his answers. According to the last debate, actually, it was just some candidates were failing to answer straight questions. Some were dodging questions.
Although many citizens have already picked their preferred candidate, some say the debates help them choose who to vote for. Voting in Uganda is scheduled to take place this Thursday. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Today's Monday, February 15th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and still to come, Mark Oldman Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, Nuet Fredebo, says the allegation that Rwanda is involved in destabilizing Burundi is a pretext to turn the political crisis in the country into a Hutu versus Tutsi problem. Jean Minani said blaming Rwanda is a strategy by Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza to deflect Burundi's problems to other countries.
It is the new pretext of Burundian government who don't want to go into talk. And now he found a new pretext to say, I can't go in a negotiation because if I go in the negotiation, I have nothing to do there. They have no answers for our problems. We have other refugees in Tanzania, in Congo, in Uganda. Why only the refugee of Rwanda will take guns to fight Burundi government? The problem is not between Rwanda and Burundi. The problem is between Burundians only. This government of Nkurunziza have to take his responsibility. So it is the responsibility of UN to say if the refugee take guns or not. Refugees are victims of the irresponsibility of Mr. Nkurunziza.
You are leader of Fredebu, which we understand is a Hutu progressive political party, and the government in Rwanda is Tutsi. Do you think the international community is trying to make this into an ethnic issue?
Yes. Those who talk that Rwanda helped refugees to go to fight Nkurunziza, like Nkurunziza, want to say that the problem is between Rwanda and Burundi. Nkurunziza wants to make this problem as an ethnic problem. But as a leader, we say no. The problem is not an ethnic problem. It's a political problem. It's a problem between one person, Khaled Nkurunziza, who wants to stay in the power without any legality, without any legitimacy. And all the person who think that it is a problem between Hutu and the Tutsi is a person who don't know our problem.
Dr. Minani, what do you make of the Rwandan foreign minister suggesting that if people are accusing her government, then Rwanda might consider to relocate Burundian refugees in Rwanda?
Refugees are refugees. To be refugee is not a simple problem, it's a big problem. To make a new location for a refugee, it is like to kill him twice. So if they take this solution, I say to them that it's the very bad solution that every responsible can take.
Jean Minani is the exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, known as Fredebu. He was speaking with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Some Somali experts say the African Union mission in Somalia is failing to protect civilians from al-Shabaab. Sunil Suri, author of a recent report on Somalia by the London-based NGO Safer World, says the withdrawal of AMISOM troops from towns is endangering the lives of civilians as well as officials who work with the AU mission and the Somali government.
Firstly, very loudly and clearly from the people we interviewed, al-Shabaab remains undefeated and it won't be defeated by a militarized approach led by AMISOM and the Somali National Army.
And why do you think the military approach seemed to be not working? Why is that?
Because the underlying question of a military approach is meant to provide security, but then security for who? And oftentimes, and I think it comes through the research, is that we found that security has been achieved for international actors. So we may be safe in London, we may be safe in Washington, but actually what does security mean, the Somali people mean? So the militarized approach hasn't worked because it's not been sustainable and it's not been effective in terms of ensuring that the Somali people's security needs are met. it often prioritizes international security priorities more so.
What are the recommendations of the report?
Firstly, that there's a pressing need to consider how to reduce dependency on Ethiopian and Kenyan forces as part of AMISOM. The longer they remain in Somalia, the negative behaviors I've discussed will continue and likely worsen. They'll provide opportunities for al-Shabaab and other armed actors to challenge the legitimacy of the federal government again. This could include the replacement of their forces by other African nations from further afield. In the longer term, this has to focus on reinforcing and building the Somali National Army. That's one recommendation. Two, where harm to civilians occurs, there needs to be accountability. So there's something called the Civilian Casualty Tracking Analysis and Response Cell, which is an important means for AMISOM to investigate and hold itself accountable. In August 2015, I'm sure you know, AMISOM-led investigation led them to admit that seven civilians had been killed in an operation with three personnel set to face a military judicial process. This mechanism is very under-resourced. International actors need to actually build this up. Another recommendation, and I think this is particularly relevant given the last few days, a greater emphasis needs to be placed on reinforcing people's security first. While AMISOM has a mission-wide protection of civilian strategy since May 2013, AMISOM should have a clear and explicit mandate from the United Nations Security Council to protect or provide immediate security to civilians in areas it takes from al-Shabaab. This can be included in the UN Security Council resolution authorizing AMISOM's presence. This would be designed so, you know, when they have Marka and they move out of the town and they come back and then Somalis are killed in the meantime by al-Shabaab, this would help to prevent a situation like that emerging.
Suni Suri is author of a recent report on Somalia by the London-based NGO Safer World. He was speaking with Harun Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. The group known as Tiniguena works in Guinea-Bissau to promote development while also conserving the country's unique resources and biodiversity. Isla Sa, a project assistant with Tiniguena, tells Ricky Schreier that political infighting in Guinea-Bissau's National Assembly makes it harder to pass laws that protect the country's natural resources and environment from exploitation.
What we're trying to do is to connect different spaces that are vital to Guinea-Bissau's sovereignty in terms of food security and also biodiversity. So we are trying to connect that to the capital. More and more people are being conscious of the monetary value of the resources. So that also can be a menace from within the community. People can start exploiting, for example, timber, because they know how much it values outside the community. And they can have the monetary income that they can invest in other things. And also, one of the threats is the tourism. When it's not done in a sustainable way, when it doesn't take into account the interests of the community, the needs of the community, when it's just exploitation tourism, you know, just comes and takes advantage of whatever is there, without, regardless of the community. And empowering the community, it's also making sure that they are aware of the benefits that tourism or other activities, economic activities, can have to that specific community. But also, they have to make sure they know the threats and the menaces that that kind of activities has. And they can make a decision that will be a conscious decision.
That was Isla Sa, a project assistant at Tiniguena. She was speaking with Ricky Schreier from Bissau. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. Kenya dismissed hosts Cameroon by 3-1. Botswana edged Uganda 3-2. And Algeria beat Egypt 3-1 at the Africa Women's Volleyball Olympic qualifiers in Yaounde on Sunday. On Saturday, Algeria dismissed Uganda in 3 straight sets. Egypt beat Botswana 3-0 and Kenya dismissed Tunisia 3-0. Earlier on Friday, Egypt beat Uganda 3-0. Cameroon pipped Tunisia 3-2 and Algeria outplayed Botswana 3-0. Today, Monday, Kenya play Egypt as Algeria Nigeria encounter Cameroon in the semifinals, while Botswana play Tunisia in a classification tie. Turning to athletics, Kenya's Florence Kiplagat clocked 1 hour 9 minutes and 19 seconds to win the Barcelona half marathon in Spain for the third consecutive year on Sunday. Vincent Kipruto won the men's race in 1 hour 2 minutes and 54 seconds. Meanwhile, in a sprint for the finish line, world cross-country champion Geoffrey Kamworor outpaced defending champion Bedan Karoki and the Africa cross-country champion Leonard Barsoton to lead a 1-2-3 Kenyan triumph in the men's 10 kilometers at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in Nairobi, Kenya on Saturday. In contrast, Kenya's All-Africa Games 10,000-meter champion Alice Aprot blew away the field to win the senior women's 10-kilometer race. Kenya's World Youth 2,000-meter steeplechase silver medalists Nixon Kiplagat and Sandra Felis Chebet won the junior men's 8 kilometers and junior women's 6 kilometers respectively. In Belgium, Morocco's Mustafa Smaili clocked 1 minute and 46.50 seconds to win the men's 800 meters at the IFAM indoor meet in Ghent on Saturday. Ethiopian Dawit Wold prevailed in 1500 meters as Kenya's Boniface Mweresa was second in 400 meters and the Central African Republic's Berange Bossi third in 60 meters. Meanwhile, Morocco's Malika Akawi and Ethiopian Habtam Alemu prevailed in the women's 1500 meters and 800 meters respectively. In cricket, Afghanistan beat Zimbabwe by 5 wickets in the finals of the plate category at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh on Friday, while South Africa beat New Zealand by 138 runs in the 11th place playoff. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts and Trivia question for today, February 15th. On this day in 1968, Henry Louis became the first African-American to lead a symphony orchestra in the United States, the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra. He began studying piano at the age of 5 and later learned to play the clarinet, as well as several string instruments. Also on this day in 1804, the New Jersey legislature approved a law calling for gradual emancipation for African-Americans. By doing so, New Jersey became the last northern state in the U.S. to outlaw slavery. And during this Black History Month, we want to tell you about Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court justice. Before that, he was legal director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Thurgood Marshall won a famous case, Brown versus the Board of Education, which desegregated public schools in the United States. Marshall died on January 24, 1993, at the age of 84. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court has one Black Associate Justice, Clarence Thomas. Did you know that John Brown was a radical white abolitionist who is famous for his participation in an anti-slavery warfare in the United States for his 1859 raid on the Federal Armory in Harpers Ferry, Virginia? Brown hoped that the attack on the armory would rouse the local slaves to rise up and claim their freedom. But his plan did not completely materialize, and Brown was captured, tried in Charleston, Virginia, and sentenced to be hanged for inciting slave rebellion. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 15th. Congratulations to Maurice Umiakuka of the Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Nigeria, and Inquin Rabos Akia of Mbinga Baptist Hospital in Bamenda, Cameroon. You are the winners of our February 12th question, which Virginia slave packaged himself to freedom in a wooden box? The answer, Henry Brown. Now here is our question for today, February 15th. Who wrote the lyrics for Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is sometimes called the Negro or Black National Anthem? Once again, who wrote the lyrics for Lift Every Voice and Sing, sometimes called the Negro or Black National Anthem? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address.
Get up, stand up.
That's it for this Monday, February 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for joining us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa.
We'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gidu Yuart, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.